accession number 18830, reel 5.
Mr. Jawotsen, reel 5. You were just explaining this point about flying techniques.
Yes. The flying techniques relate to the length of time one was a pilot. Being a pilot is stage one, really. Being a military pilot is stage two. Being a confident and efficient military pilot is stage three. I feel that roughly is the thing about it. And it took us longer. Well, longer for the wartime when the expectations were so much higher and time to train so much shorter, to be confident, to be able to fly under all weather conditions. I have not yet come to the detail of how difficult it was really to fly these nighttime flights and survive them. All this depended how primarily on the pilot, because he had to have confidence for the whole crew. He was more experienced than anybody else in the crew. He had done, like myself, at least 10 operational flights as a second pilot, and therefore had a feel for what would be expected. The crew didn't know anything like this. Therefore, to come to an attack, to a point where one attack, it, obviously the length of the time and the number of U-boats coming and going, there could be some attacks where a new crew could find a U-boat and attack. But this would be extremely rare. The people who did best were the good crews of the older type that had trained most likely before the war, most likely were regulars when the war started, and certainly a large part of the large number of the crew, well, certainly the pilots were. So going back to these attacks on the U-boats and being able to cope with the enemy fighters and the other problems that arose. This is where the crew that had the experience, had the confidence, would be the one that would survive and be able to perform an attack.
Can I ask you, if you were attacked by a German fighter, what would be the technique of escaping?
Well, it very much depended on where you were attacked. I'm confusing this because there's daytime flights, and I went then to night flights, which were totally different, except for the period that one flew during day. But the night had other requirements of the flight itself. In daytime, one would hope that there would be some clouds around. They tended, fighters, mainly Ju-88s, tended to fly in flights of, say, 4, 6. Never that I know singly. And if caught in open, as people were with day like this, maybe blue sky, the chances were very small that one could survive and fight back. And survive. Yet people did that, and there were in Polish squadron. There was particularly two pilots. One of them trained me in the OTU. He was my commander. He survived over an hour's attacks by Ju-88s, and although people were wounded, he had the nerve and the stamina and the ability to maneuver the aircraft to come out alive out of this.
Would you go down to a low level or what?
Well, we flew even in daytime. The level really was around 2,000 feet, if I recall, in daytime. We never flew higher than that. At night, we flew at 500 feet. So I've calculated, didn't take much calculation, that you had 15 seconds between your height around 500 or 800 to the sea level. I calculated this because we had lots of engine problems in this night flying. And when the engine started packing up, and you had full load of stuff on board, bombs, everything else, you had 15 seconds to sort yourself out, or you were in water. And I know of no recorded situation or occasion where Wellington 14 landed and the crew survived in open sea. It was not an aircraft which could not survive landing on water. It would break up. The presence of the tower, of this moving, and the front being open would break up the aircraft almost instantly. And I used to watch the rescues, and I've never seen a Wellington 14 survive this kind of thing. So you had to sort yourself out, whatever was happening to you at 500 feet at that level immediately, or you were pretty well finished. So we had big losses in the Wellington 14s. This is out of statistic. In the first year of Wellington's, of the night flying by the Leelite aircraft, half of the number of Leelite aircraft were lost. There were about 90, I think, at one stage. 45 were lost, just disappeared, or some of them said attacking, and that would be the last word. But an awful lot just flew into the sea. When you put your Leelite on, the reflection often was rather deceptive, and you had about how much time? Bomb door open, this turret down, light shining into you, there is a U-boat ahead of you, all kinds of things. Bumping, air is, you know, bumpy. Your chances of hitting the water were great. So, and Wellington 14 was really unable to defend itself against enemy fighters. It could fight for a few moments if the clouds, if the condition were right. For example, we were attacked. You'd see suddenly somebody would shout a fighter or something like that. And if you had clouds, you just put the throttles fully on and hoped you could reach it before they had a chance, because of the weight, the engines were much more powerful, about a third more power than the first Wellingtons. The Wellingtons which managed to fight were the first Wellingtons who won C, the bomber command, light, although not very powerful, but maneuverable. The Wellington 14 was quite a heavy aircraft, comparatively, relatively to the first one. More powerful, but more difficult to maneuver and to defend against the fighters.
Did you come into contact, were you attacked by enemy fighters
yourself? Yes, at night, yes.
What happened?
I'm here. Well, they were defending a U-boat that was on the surface, close to the French coast. And already they walloped the Halifax, which I saw next day and damaged, and that had to go away. And we attacked. I could see, you could see the firefight going on as we're approaching, and did the usual approach down to 25 feet, bomb door open, and just when I was about to switch the, and of course, all the time the radar operator is reporting to me fighters, you know, starboard port, approaching closer. And from the two sides, and well, U-boat in front. And just at that point, the U-boat threw what is it called, the light,
a light on a U-boat?
No, the U-boat fired the...
Very light?
No, it wasn't very light. It brilliant light shines.
Flare,
but parachute flare, you know, on the parachute, slow moving flare. And this is pitch black night, and suddenly, totally blinded. And at the same time, the gunners or the radar operator tells me they're firing at us. I dropped the bombs, but I saw nothing. I couldn't tell, just white. Managed to shut the bomb doors and maneuver somehow out, and we just maneuvered around, managed to get away. They were firing us several times, so we that was the kind of attack. But others had other experiences.
Was your plane damaged in that incident?
I think it might have. Yes, I think it was slightly damaged. Yes, if I recall.
Was that early on in your operation?
Yes. Oh, yes. I was, in fact, not with my crew. Our navigator was ill, taken. In fact, he had cancer of the stomach.
Was that the most dangerous incident you were in?
I don't think. I think there were other types of incidents where, for example, boat engines stopped. We had a spell of problems with the engines. This related, as I understood it, to the nature of the petrol that was used in those days. And plugs would be carbonized because of it was the, I think, the petrol. Efficiency of the petrol improved, but also it was not really suitable for the engines, and it would foul up the I think spark plugs, and the engine would just start just milling, you know, suddenly the engine wouldn't work. And I had this happen on both engines at the same time, so I can recall that. Yeah, I can recall that to this day.
Now, according to your logbook, you were at this place in Cornwall that you mentioned, David Stone Moore, for about 6 months from June to December 1940.
Yeah, then I went to OTU.
Then you went to OTU, but then you returned to
Chivna.
304 Squadron in Chivna.
Yeah.
February 44.
Yeah, so this is I returned as a captain. Yes.
And then it moved to Ben Bekula. From September 44 to February 45. Do you remember whether that second period in 44-45 with 304 Squadron was much different from the first period?
Well, it was in a way in that we used only these Lelight aircraft.
Wellingtons?
Wellington 14, yes. Lelight Wellingtons. By 14, I mean Mark 14. It was period, of course, of a lot of activity because that covers the D-Day, our flying to patrol to prevent U-boats from getting to the armada, you know, to the invasion. It was in that period that when I was the captain, and during that period we had all kinds of things, weather engine, weather, you know, there's, for example, a situation where we came back after our, there were only, the way it was worked out, if I recall, around 10 hour, the petrol you had was enough for just under 10-hour flight, operational flight, plus something like 20-minute reserve. And that was the way one had to operate. Therefore, the group would recall aircraft if it looked that the bases were being fouled up and there may be difficulties in landing. But on occasions, they also messed it up and we would return and the whole south was under clouds and all the base, all the aerodromes were closed down because of zero visibility. So they would say, go to RAF somewhere in Newcastle or something like this, that kind of thing. And it's, you're already 9 hours in flight. That was one of these difficult ones. And well, on specific occasion, is the one of the flights which finished up in RAF Valley, which used, as it turned out later, used FIDO system for landing in very bad weathers. It was an experience which I don't think that many pilots had actually go through. But it saved us from having to bail out, which seemed to be the only other solution to our not being able to land anywhere else.
You also told me earlier on about your experiences on D-Day, if you can repeat that, please.
On D-Day, or immediately after D-Day, when I flew into the channel, I had the experience of seeing the Royal Navy, as far as once I could see, the ships bombarding the French coast or maybe further inland all night, and then at first daylight returning back to Britain. Also, it was around France, close to France, in the Channel Islands, that the Germans fought for a long time afterwards, and where there was quite a vicious anti-aircraft firing that we had experienced during our operations.
And you were telling me the location of RAF Chivenor as well.
RAF Chivenor is located in North Devon on the coast, or very close to the coast. It was in operation long after the war, used by the RAF.
And after the war, did you consider going back to Poland?
The ideas on what to do after the war really underlie the whole story, because for us Poles, the war was fought on other fronts, and the importance of winning or losing was related not just to our being part of the operational group, but it also depended of what was happening elsewhere in Europe and what was being done to the Poles in Poland. And it was on this basis that we had to decide what to do with ourselves when the war ended. And it was certainly one of the most difficult decisions one had to undertake in one's life.
How did you find settling down in England after the war?
I found it difficult, like any ex-serviceman to begin with, just being out of the excitement of wartime operations. That alone would require some adjustments. But we Poles had, of course, a difficult time. We were not very popular at the time because at the time Soviet Russia was extremely popular and welcome, and we were interfering with what Russia was trying to do, or what people felt Russia deserved to have. We were causing problems with our demands and wanting a government there and so on. So there was a time of great unpopularity for Poles in Britain, and in fact other books tell us that almost all the research shows that most people wanted Poles to go back to Poland as soon as possible, under almost any conditions. It happened that I was, I spent nearly 2 years in hospitals after the war, and in some way this has made the transition a little more easy in a way, in that I wasn't immediately exposed to difficulties of living a civilian life and having to encounter the hostility and so on.
Did any English people ever say to you and make any remarks to you?
Oh, yes.
What
yes.
Kind of things would
well,
they say?
They'd say, why don't you go back to Poland? In a variety of ways. I had the RAF squadron leader who I wanted to get a grant to study, and I needed a signature from the Air Ministry. And I didn't find out about the deadline until very close to it, and I instead of having going back to my base, which was somewhere in up north of Lincolnshire, I went to the Air Ministry to shortcut this. And then a squadron leader called me in and said, how dare you come here? Who do you think you are? Why don't you Poles go to South America or somewhere and stop causing us problems? And it was, I recall, a WAF officer came and just moved me bodily away from him. That's the more extreme example, but that is.
Did you get the signature?
Not from him, no. I had to travel to my base.
What type of problems did he have in mind, did he say?
Just fed up with Poles causing problems and being difficult and politically difficult and demanding jobs, wanting to work and whatever.
Did it eventually change for you, for Polish people?
Yes, gradually, I'm sure, yes. I lived in Canada for about 12 years, but I think there's been a lot of change in approach to Poles.
In England.
The thing is, during the war, people were free and open and welcoming everybody. When the war ended, the soldiers came back from, and people came back to the country. They wanted to resume the life as it was before the war, among other things, which, of course, wasn't quite possible to the extent that they hoped. And that was part, I think, of it. But all these problems accumulated. And after the war, immediately after the war, there was this sort of reversal to being rather wanting to be isolated from all these foreign problems. And that included Poles, who were a visible sign that there were serious problems around in the world. And people didn't want that.
And how was it for Poles in Canada?
Oh, much better. Much better because there are, really practically you could say that except for the native Indians, everybody else is a foreigner in a way, in that people have come to live there. Therefore, it is less likely that people would be able to specifically pick on any other nation. You know, there will be some undercurrents of between the various countries, but nothing serious.
Which part of Canada were you in?
In around Montreal. I spent some time at McGill University. And
studying what?
I studied sciences.
So you were in French-speaking Canada?
In French-speaking, yes, because my brother actually was educated at Louvain University and went to Canada and found a job in French Canada.
Years were you in Montreal area?
Sorry?
Which years were you in Montreal?
I was Montreal and Bay Area, which is outside, between 1956 and 1970, roughly.
Why did you decide to come back to England?
I was a research scientist with the Canadian Industries Limited, which was a subsidiary of ICI. And ICI offered to bring me to their central research laboratories here in Rancorn. My wife was English, and we had contacts, connections, and they offered to pay everything, offered an interesting position. So we came back.